It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Pett.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Dozens of gas stations and other businesses around the state are getting an infusion of federal grant funding to build high-speed electric vehicle charging stations. Wisconsin trails some of our neighboring states in the number of EV charging stations available to drivers.
The State Department of Transportation recently awarded about $23 million in federal funds, and construction on these charging stations could begin this summer. To learn more about the electric charging network that is taking shape here, we have Ben Belke, Clean Technology Manager for Renew Wisconsin, a nonprofit renewable energy advocacy organization. Ben, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Yes, thank you so much for having me. So happy to be on.
Well, can you explain the significance of this federal investment in Wisconsin?
Yes, absolutely. The $23 million from NEVI is so huge for the state of Wisconsin. It really solves that chicken or the egg argument when it comes to electric vehicles and electric vehicle infrastructure. Being able to make it easier for electric vehicles to be adopted, as well as spurring new tourism and alleviating concerns of travel and the ability for fast, reliable charging while on the go, I think is huge for the state of Wisconsin. And it really, really is going to, I think, be the start of huge electric vehicle adoption within Wisconsin.
But will this help alleviate range anxiety where drivers are reluctant to take their EV on those long trips for fear they might not be able to plug in?
Yeah, that's a great question. And that has been a concern in the past, and I think NEVI will really solve that. So NEVI not only is in the state of Wisconsin, but it's across the United States for electric vehicle infrastructure, as well as it has DC Level 3 fast charging. Basically, what that means is it's the fastest version of charging that we currently have. And so for some cars, you can get below 30 minutes of charging, which is fast, gets it a little bit closer to what people are used to when they are traveling over those long distances. As well as, I really want to commend WisDOT for the charger locations that they have, because, like you mentioned, range anxiety is not just about the fast, but it's about where they're located. And if you look at the map that is dedicated for Wisconsin, there is such short distances between them. They did a great job at finding those locations. So people should not be struggling to find a reliable charging source while they're on those traveling excursions.
And I want to note this program that you say NEVI is the National Electric Vehicle Infrastructure Formula Program. So when you look at this funding for EV charging stations supporting 53 fast charging projects statewide, what is the state strategy on where these stations will be located?
Yeah, basically what they did is they looked at where they could be. They want to be 50 miles apart from each other. And for this first round of funding, they got as close to that as they could. And they looked at where are the main areas of travel. So you're talking about like 151, you're talking about 90, 94. Some of these popular areas of travel that people will take from location to location, that's where they looked along those interstates for this first round of funding, and really have found those really close spots where they're close to each other, as well as about a mile off the interstate as well. So keeping it really close there.
I'm going to pull off the interstate, and then I'm going to see a Quick Trip. And I want to note here, nearly half of these EV charging projects will be going to Quick Trip locations. Is there a reason why Quick Trip received the most locations of any business on this round of funding?
Yeah, that's a great question. And we're definitely looking into that about the reasons for people, for what they were selected. I think it is great that Quick Trip and other Wisconsin companies have really taken the charge on this. The fact that it's not just Quick Trip, as well as Menards, and as well as so many different Wisconsin companies, I think is so great. And yeah, I think it's really, they're willing to put the chargers in. They're willing to have it match their business model really well. So I'm really, really happy for Quick Trip, as well as all the other Wisconsin-based companies within this round of funding.
Talking with Ben Belke, Clean Technology Manager for Renew Wisconsin, as we look at the recent funding, federal funding for new electric vehicle charging stations around Wisconsin and where they will be. Ben, Minnesota, Michigan, and Illinois have high numbers of accessible charging stations, more than Wisconsin. Iowa, The outlier here, the only state bordering us with fewer stations, that is from the Department of Energy's alternative fueling station locator. Why are we behind our neighbors in infrastructure?
Yeah, Wisconsin has lagged behind in electric vehicle infrastructure, but I think what this is going to do is it's going to set us up to be on par. That's the whole goal with the National Electric Vehicle Infrastructure Plan, is to get every state on par with each other over those long distance of traveling. And it's really going to allow us to get a lot better with those fast chargers. You're right, we are lagging a little bit behind when it comes to that local and the more local state of charging, and we're going to get there. It's a process, right? Get these fast chargers up there and then look at some of the local charging and get that infrastructure up to par as well. But it's really great to see us really going to be across the board, very similar to other states. So whether you're in Wisconsin and want to travel across the country, or whether you're in Wisconsin and want to travel to many of the great locations within Wisconsin, you shouldn't be concerned about that range once this is built out.
Okay, so what differences are there between our current chargers available in Wisconsin and these proposed EV charging stations on how fast it would be able to restore the battery?
Yeah, great question. So there are currently three levels of charging. There's level one, which is your traditional 120 volts. So this is what you would plug a toaster or your phone charger into. And this charges a little bit slower, and it's great, though, for if you're planning at being at a location for an extended period of time. And really, that's great for it's the lowest cost option for people in their homes. Then there's level two, which is what you would commonly see if people have a battery electric vehicle, as well as it's probably what you see most common within the location. So level two is great for if you have a plug-in hybrid, it's a fast charger, or if you have a complete battery electric vehicle, it's perfect for that as well, over those overnight charging or at hotels where you have a decent amount of time, as well as workplace charging. Level two is perfectly fine and perfectly viable for that. Level three, the ones that we are seeing with this electric vehicle build out, these have a higher power and will thus charge them a lot faster. So sometimes with new electric vehicles can get into sub 30 range of charging. So that's why these are going to be put along the infrastructure or along our interstates and high routes of travel, just because of that build out. And it allows it to be easier for traveling over those long distances or when you need a quick boost here and there. It just makes that a lot easier. So it's just a lot faster of a charging than what we have traditionally had with our level two charging.
Okay, so sub 30, meaning it would take like less than 30 minutes to get that charge and be
correct,
back on the interstate.
Yes, absolutely.
All right, well, let's take a look at the legislation that had to change here. Wisconsin was able to access the federal funding because Governor Tony Evers signed this new legislation into law in March. And one of the law changes how EV chargers bill for the cost of electricity. Why is this change important?
Yeah, so in that act, it changed it from being charged by the hour to being charged by the kilowatt hour. And that has a couple of different importances with it. One, it did open up the NEVI funding to the state of Wisconsin, which is super, super important, obviously, to get these projects underway and built for the state of Wisconsin. But what is also important when it's talking about kilowatt hour versus charging by the hour, which is what we traditionally had, is if you have two vehicles next to each other, you have one that's a Tesla that charges at a faster rate versus, say, an older version of an electric vehicle or, say, an older Nissan Leaf that charges at a slower rate. If you're charging by the time-wise that you're there, so charging by the hour, virtually the Tesla is getting that energy technically for cheaper than the Nissan Leaf, because the Nissan Leaf is charging at a slower rate than that Tesla would. So that's also an important thing to figure out with this. And it really gets it closer to what we're used to, which is gallons, right? You can go to your gas station, you know, oh, it's going to be X amount of gallons per gallon today. And it's the same thing. It's a standard charging unit of kilowatt hours that you're putting into your vehicle.
Will this standardization and this type of transparency, do you think, make an impact on people looking for EVs in the future for their next vehicle?
Absolutely. I think it's going to really help people see and make sure that electric vehicles are right for them and their families. and really increasing that adoption as well. And really knowing, do the numbers figure out? And I think most people will find that they do.
Researchers with the International Council on Clean Transportation, they say that households living in condos and apartments and duplexes, they have barriers to charging electric vehicles at home. What should Wisconsin do to improve access to EV charging for people who don't live in single-family homes?
Yeah, that's something that we're definitely looking at Renew. There's a few things that we can do. I think this electric vehicle charging infrastructure is going to be a huge step forward. It's bringing us a lot closer to, again, that very similar gasoline style of being able to fill up before you go home. I think that's going to be one thing that can be opened up with additional chargers that are going to be put on, as well as we are currently looking at Renew, those barriers of what is causing some people who are in condos to not be able to have that electric vehicle adoption. But I think, like I mentioned before, I think that the level three chargers that are going to be along these routes are going to be such a huge impact for the state of Wisconsin and might make it a lot easier for people who maybe have not been able to transition to electric vehicle because they can only have one car at a time. Being able to make it closer to what they're used to and potentially be able to charge before they get back to their house. But that is something that we're definitely looking at Renew and looking at internally of how we can best help those people.
In our just final seconds together, the remaining $55 million in federal funding here from this program, what are you watching for and how it's allocated?
Yeah, I think what we should be doing is looking at the data, and I think they're going to do a great job of that, but looking at the data and seeing where we have those holes that are currently open, as well as I would really love to see us looking at maybe some of the two popular tourism locations as well of where people like to travel, maybe along the coastline of the Great Lakes, whether it's Great River Road. I think some of these might be some really, really awesome locations to put additional chargers to, again, continue to spur tourism within the state of Wisconsin.
Ben, thank you for joining us.
Yes, thank you so, so much for having me.
That is Ben Belke, Clean Technology Manager at Renew Wisconsin. And for disclosure, Renew Wisconsin is a business sponsor of WPR.
Attention to plants this time of year in nature and in our own yards and gardens, and it turns out plants are a lot more complicated than we might think. A UW biologist shares the latest research on the inner lives of plants coming up here on WPR News. It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. In January 2023, the Lac des Flambeaux Band of Lake Superior Chippewa barricaded four roads on their reservation. For residents cut off from their homes, the move seemed to come out of the blue. But in fact, it came after a decade-long dispute between the tribe and the town of Lac des Flambeaux. As Danielle Kading reports, a year and a half later, that dispute appears to be no closer to an end.
So the first barricade, set of barricades, was right here.
Mary Poussin walks along Elsie Lake Lane. A retiree from Madison, Poussin says she and her husband bought their home there in 2017. It was always a dream of hers to live in the area. Then the tribe blocked off her road and several others, limiting access to and from homes. The barricades brought intense controversy and made national news headlines. Homeowners living on the northern Wisconsin reservation felt their rights were violated. Tribal officials have said little about the case publicly, but last month they sat down to speak in depth about their views on the longstanding dispute over access to roads crossing tribal lands.
It turned into a hard back and forth to the point where push came to shove and said, okay, well, if you guys are refusing to work with us as a tribe, then we may have to consider blocking access until you take us serious.
George Thompson is the tribe's vice chair. He says tribal leaders first notified the town about a decade ago that rights of way on the roads had expired. Leaders of the tribe and town met various times to negotiate their renewal. When talks stalled, tribal leaders decided to block the roads.
We tried to find peaceful resolutions, but it doesn't happen all the time.
That's Lac-Di-Flambeau Tribal President John Johnson Sr. The lack of easements and temporary road closures have since become the subject of multiple lawsuits. The federal government has sued the town for trespassing on the tribe's lands, and the town has sued the Bureau of Indian Affairs for removing the four roads from a national tribal transportation inventory that requires they remain open to the public. Homeowners are also challenging the agency's decision. Johnson says the dispute is part of a broader effort among tribes to exert their sovereignty.
It's happened in different states already. You know, we just want what's ours and we want to protect it.
Federal policy in the last 50 years has become more supportive of tribal self-determination and sovereignty, according to Monty Mills. He's director of the Native American Law Center at the University of Washington. Mills says tribes, in turn, have more technical and legal power.
They're in a position to assert those rights, really, that they haven't been in.
Even so, Mills says tribes have seen mixed success in federal court cases. When tribal rights are at stake, it's risky to bring cases that could end up before the Supreme Court.
It's been a really challenging place, I would say, for tribal claims. And that's largely because of this sort of stepping away from or minimizing reliance on some of those foundational doctrines, like the role of treaties, the place of tribal sovereignty.
Lac-Di-Flambeau tribal leaders say they are worried that litigation could mean losing more of their rights. Meanwhile, affected homeowners are frustrated with the lack of a resolution, including Mary Poussin.
We're still in the state of not knowing what's going to happen next. There's no long-term solution to this on the horizon.
Homeowners fear the town will run out of money to keep the roads open. Access payments to the tribe have grown by $2,000 each month. Local leaders admit they won't be able to pay indefinitely. On Friday, the town board voted to reduce monthly payments beginning in July due to a lack of funds. Lac-Di-Flambeau Town Board Supervisor and tribal member Gloria Cobb said in a public meeting that the town is still showing good faith by paying some amount.
And looking forward to opening up the lines of communication with the tribe.
Thompson, the tribe's vice chair, has said the board would be breaking its commitment to the tribe if the town can't afford the payments.
Unfortunately, we may have to provide notice in closing the road again.
Both town and tribal leaders have said they're willing to negotiate, but tribal officials say any attempts to mediate the dispute shouldn't mean the tribe has to give up more of its land, rights, or sovereignty. Danielle Kading, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Tomorrow, we'll hear more from homeowners caught up in the dispute and find out how the conflict has affected the community. Find more on this story at WPR.org. This is Wisconsin Today.
Now, scientists have made some intriguing discoveries about plants in recent years.
Trees send signals to each other in forests. They may warn each other of threats.
Some plants show an ability to store data at the molecular level, and they have surprisingly complex systems that allow them to react and adapt to their environments.
Are plants more complicated, maybe smarter than we realize? A new book called The Light Eaters makes that argument. Its author visited the lab of Simon Gilroy, botany professor at UW-Madison, who studies the way plants react to their environment. He shares his research now. Simon, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
No, it's my pleasure. Absolutely.
Big picture, Simon, we may think, or I may think of plants anyway, as being pretty much, you know, inert. But how much more is going on under the surface than I realize?
Yeah, it is. It's true. If you look at plants, for a lot of people, they just don't seem to be doing a lot. I think we've all seen those absolutely amazing time-lapse movies of plants growing. So they're clearly active pieces of biology, but they feel like they're operating at a very different time frame for us. It's been called slow life. But actually, the technology of being able to understand what's going on improves every year. And we're now at the point where we can look at plants and be able to pull out the activities. And we're beginning to realize they are just as active as we are at our time frames, things happening at seconds.
What are some of those things going on in that short time frame that's leading some people to rethink how we think about the time scale of plants?
So one of the classic examples we have now is, imagine that you're a plant and you're being eaten, right? And for, you know, Wisconsin gardeners, we're putting out our tomato plants and getting ready for the summer. But insects are everywhere and plants have to defend themselves against it. And they're really good at doing that. But imagine that you're being eaten by an insect. if your responses take 2 or 3 days, right, you're going to be gone before you've had a chance to defend yourself. So now that we have sort of ways of teasing apart what the plants are doing, we can see that when that insect starts to chomp on a leaf, that leaf generates a bunch of chemical and electrical signals almost instantaneously, you know, the kind of way that you might think that we would if an insect started chewing on us. We go, ow. The plant is generating signals at that time frame, and those signals move throughout the plant. So it's not a nervous system, but you can kind of think of it, it's doing the same thing. One part of the plant is within seconds to minutes telling the rest of the part of the plant, that it's being damaged.
I understand this is something you actually work on in your lab, giving a plant, in effect, an owie and seeing what happens next. Can you tell us a little bit about how you do this research and what kind of things you're finding?
Yeah, it's very, very much that the more that we peer into the plant, the more we see the plants are super active. So what we've been able to do is take a genetic tool. It's a modified protein that you can actually visualize. It's fluorescent, so you can just see it. We engineer that into plants, and that protein has been tweaked so that when the plant generates a signal, and the signal that we're really interested in is changes in the level of the calcium ions in the cell, that's a signal that we're using at the moment. That's how mammalian cells, how human cells signal amongst themselves. Plants do a very, very similar thing. So we take this visualization tool, and now in real time, we can do things like cut a leaf and see the signals propagate throughout the plant. And that's opened up this window of seeing, when you wound a plant, or even when you touch a plant, signals are generated almost instantaneously, and those signals propagate throughout the plant. Just like if I were to touch you, you would have a signal which is generated by your touch receptors in your skin, and then that would be passed to your brain, and then you would know you'd been touched. Similar kind of thing, very different mechanism, but a similar kind of thing for plants.
And that's what I wanted to ask about. If I pinch my arm here, I know that it's coming through nerves, right? I have a nervous system that goes to my brain. Well, nerves and brains are things, I think, that plants don't have, right?
Absolutely not. So we know what a brain is. And if you look inside a plant, you can't find the anatomical structure, which is very clearly our brain. And there are no nerves. But biology has to accomplish some common things. Plants have to be able to sense the world around them, just like we have to. And they have to be able to process lots and lots of different kinds of information, just like we have to. And somehow they have to mush all of that together and do the right thing at the end, the appropriate thing. We have the luxury of this absolutely awesome information processing engine sitting in our heads. So plants don't have a brain, but somewhere inside them, there is information which is being put together and calculations made and working out what the correct output is going to be. You can imagine it's a sunny day and it starts to rain and then an insect starts to eat you. And all of those things have to come together inside the plant somehow for it to kind of know what to do. And it's that knowing bit of it, which is the big black box that we still really don't understand.
All right. Now, what are the reactions before we start to dig into that black box? What kind of things are plants doing? They feel, I'm going to put that in quotes, they sense this insect eating it. The signal goes through the whole of the plant or whatever. What does it do then? Or what kind of strategies do plants do to say, no, I'm not going to get eaten here?
Yeah. So the thing that they don't do, which is the thing that we just is so intuitive to us that it sort of sits in the background of all of our responses, is they just can't get up and leave. So plants are masters of chemistry. So they'll do a lot of making toxins, making themselves unpalatable, and they'll switch on a lot of biochemical pathways to make a lot of biologically active compounds. They will switch on a whole range of their genes to sort of reprogram themselves. And one thing that plants are fantastic at doing is just soaking up what the world has to throw at them, and then regenerating and rebuilding parts of the plant. So there's a whole array of things built around the fact that plants, because they're photosynthetic, can just make so much stuff that they can deal with the world by kind of building things in response.
Talking to Simon Gilroy, botany professor at UW-Madison, about the latest research and how plants interact with the outside world, take in information and react to it. Okay, Simon, I've danced around the I word here, intelligence. Some people look at this and say, well, hold on, they're taking input from the outside world. They're comparing it to some kind of reaction system inside. A decision comes out, a reaction comes out. Is this a kind of intelligence? I don't know, maybe this is one more for a philosopher than a botanist, but what are your thoughts on that?
I think it's a great debate to have. The problem is that we're people. And so our experience of the world is very obviously how we work. And so one of the things that we do as humans, we anthropomorphize all the time. We even inanimate objects, we attribute them like human characteristics. And it's just built into like our DNA of how we interact with the world and think the world operates, because, you know, we know how we operate. And so that must be how everything else operates. And we have a great language to describe how we make decisions and how we think and how we behave. And we use those words when we're describing, let's say, how plants work. So plant behavior, or that plant looks like it's thinking about whether the sun's come out. The words have a lot of meaning to them, which are just intrinsic. Like they're built into the language and they're built into a description of how we work. And so that can sometimes totally get in the way. So when you talk about intelligence, it's just the knee-jerk reaction of thinking about how we think and thinking about how our brain works. But like you did, if you rephrase it and reset the question of, if you consider intelligence to be taking in information, processing it to give an appropriate output, which for biology helps you survive in the world, then you could say, yeah, totally, plants are intelligent. But the intelligence word might be getting in the way there. We like to call it biological intelligence to try and shift the debate away from thinking about brains and nerves and how we work.
Well, let me throw out another bad metaphor here. Plants, it sounds like, have some kind of capacity to store information that then new inputs get run across. Sounds a little like a computer to me. What do we know about how plants store data that they've received or grown up with and then use it?
Plants very, very clearly can store information. Another way to say that is, plants can remember what has happened in the past. And again, that comes with the baggage of, we know what we think of when we talk about remembering. Mm-hmm. The machinery within the plant that makes that work, that is still a hot topic of debate. It's very clear that plants somehow encode their history in them. So a plant which has been experienced drought will respond a little bit different from a plant that hasn't seen drought in the past. So we know that within the molecular machinery that makes plants work, there must be this sort of memory component to it. And we know that in response to environmental signals, plants change how their proteins work, they change which genes they're switched on. So we have lots and lots of candidates. But again, we've now pushed to the very limits of kind of our understanding of how it works.
Now, we've been focusing mostly on what's happening within one plant here, right? That the plant feels the insect chewing on it and it does stuff. There's some research on communication between plants where, these insects are eating me. I'm putting out some kind of chemical signal so that other plants can be prepared.
They absolutely do. For instance, chemical signals produced by one plant can be sensed by another plant to trigger a response. And a classic example of that would be a thing called green leaf volatiles. Every time that you mow the lawn, that smell, that very characteristic smell of cut grass, that is volatile chemicals coming from the wounded grass. If you take those chemicals and then add them to another plant, waft them over another plant, that other plant will trigger defense responses against physical damage. So that we absolutely know that that goes on. Here is the tricky conundrum. Are those plants which are responding to the volatile chemicals, are they just bystanders? Are they eavesdropping on what's happened? So that the chemical that was released by the damaged plant was just the chemistry of being damaged. And as far as the damaged plant's concerned, it's just responding to being damaged. And the plants which are able to eavesdrop on the signal are using it, but difficult to come up with words which don't just give it a human flavor, but there's no intention. There's no directional communication.
As we wrap up, Simon, what is the biggest mystery for you as you're researching that you're hoping to figure out when it comes to plants?
The field of plant biology has made absolutely enormous progress in understanding the senses. So we know how plants know whether it's day or night. We know they even know what time of day it is. We know the molecular clock that they have. We know how they can sense the levels of nitrogen in the soil. We know a tremendous amount about the sort of the machinery of how the sensing works. And research has made a lot of progress about the molecular changes which that then triggers. The black box is still, how do you put it all together? How do you take all of this information and turn it into, like, and again, we're just going to talk about it as if it was a human. How you can make a plant think, right, without a brain? That is a huge question. And people are making steady progress towards at least thinking about it. We totally don't have an answer.
Super interesting. Simon, thanks for joining us today.
Oh, no, my pleasure. Absolutely.
That's Simon Gilroy, professor of botany at UW-Madison.
Coming up, a new Center for Black Excellence breaks ground in Madison later this month. The center's founder shares its story.
In order to make Madison feel like a place of greater belonging for its black population and the state for that matter, this is space that's really been set aside that reinforces a deep sense of cultural identity.
That's next on WPR News.
It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. When Reverend Alex G. puts a ceremonial shovel in the ground later this month, he's hoping to persuade more black people to stay in Wisconsin.
He says a lot of black people leave Madison and other Wisconsin communities because they lack a strong sense of belonging and of cultural connection to the state.
G. is the co-founder of the Center for Black Excellence and Culture, which has its groundbreaking scheduled for Juneteenth in Madison. And his vision is for the center to provide a physical gathering space to fill that need.
Reverend G is also lead pastor of Fountain of Life Covenant Church in Madison. He founded the Nehemiah Center for Urban Leadership Development. Reverend G, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
It's really exciting to be here. It's good to be in the studios again.
Now, can you describe the Center for Black Excellence and Culture and your vision for what it'll be?
Oh, sure. It's this beautiful 37,000 square foot facility that's going to be situated on Madison's south side. And it is a place for revitalizing black culture, community development, leadership development, innovation, creativity, in order to make Madison feel like a place of greater belonging for its black population and the state for that matter. This is space that's really been set aside that reinforces a deep sense of cultural identity. The lack thereof is one of the major things that black residents and professionals who move to Wisconsin or who are in Wisconsin working lament. They move to other areas, not only because of weather and climate, but because there are greater places for cultural reinforcement, which is important to them and their children.
This is the product, as I understand it, of years of conversations people sharing these stories. Can you talk about the conversations you had that helped develop this idea?
Sure. Well, I can remember having some of these discussions when I was a college student at Wisconsin in the early 80s, because people who are not from Wisconsin, black people not from Wisconsin, always talk about how this feels like a different place. And I don't think I understood that until my first trip to Detroit as a UW-Madison recruiter and admissions office. And I went to Detroit and I went to a mall and everyone, Radio Shack staff, Allstate staff, every store was black. I felt like I was having one of those Twilight Zone moments. And I said, now I understand my brother-in-law when he says Madison is different, because I'd never been in a place where or space where I was the majority. And so people leave Madison because it's difficult to feel that sense of belonging, because that cultural reinforcement helps you to feel seen and respected. And it means that you're not an anomaly and you're not an oddity. And so having cultural space that reinforces our identity and our sense of belonging here in Madison is one of the things that I think will keep people here longer. And that's what came out of the conversations. If I had a place to take my children, if I could meet other people, if I could make sure my children understood the richness of our culture and not just the slave trade, that would help me to thrive here. And so this has come out of conversations involving over 1,000 black folks in our community saying what they needed. And the number one need wasn't more social services. It was a sense of cultural reinforcement.
You and I have talked in the past about Wisconsin in general, Madison in particular, as being not great places for black people. A lot of measures, health outcomes, educational outcomes, housing access, the list goes on
exactly.
And on. Do you see this center as something that's going to help deal with a lot of those big issues we've been talking about for so many years?
I think it'll help with part of it. It certainly won't change infant mortality rate or mass incarceration rate. But what it will do is it will slow the black brain drain that we're experiencing in Wisconsin. So I think the people who can help to speak into the issues, create new solutions, who otherwise would stay here in the state of Wisconsin, move on to other places, because it is so difficult to be here. And it's not as if Wisconsin is just so hostile, like crosses are being burned on your lawn. But in this day and time in 2024, many of my colleagues are still the first and the only on their boards, in their neighborhoods, on their jobs, in their entertainment spaces. And now, when you want to go out and socialize, you are still the first and only. So we have to stop that bleed from somewhere. And when the individuals who normally leave because it's just too much, when they stay, it increases the pool of people who could sit down and say, how do we address this? How do we prevent this? What can we do to bring greater attention to this? So by keeping more of those folks here in the state of Wisconsin, it just helps us to build a stronger team of people who are creating solutions and alternatives.
You mentioned a black brain drain happening in Wisconsin. Obviously, this center is directed toward black people, but do you see a benefit for the state at large, everybody else, if we stop losing this potentially important sector of our population?
Oh, definitely, because I think all of the state is really wrestling with how do we really live up to our state motto of being forward if our approach to race relations is backwards, anything but forward. Other communities are wrestling with the same thing. La Crosse, Whitewater, Milwaukee, they're struggling with how do we make this attractive to black people as well? And so I think that it will change things in that more people will stay and will help to make Madison and greater Madison and Wisconsin more attractive. But again, the more people we have here around the state being a part of the solution, being mentors, raising their children here, sending their children to college here, buying homes here, all of that is what you need in order to make this a truly diverse and welcoming state.
Now, getting back to the Center for Black Excellence in Culture and some of its goals, you wrote in a piece, this is a while back in the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, that you want to fill in a lack of what you call life after work opportunities
exactly.
Black people miss around Wisconsin. What do you mean by that?
When I travel to places, D.C., Atlanta, Chicago, Detroit, that have large black populations, it's nothing to go out to a black jazz club, coffee shop, wine shop. And again, there's just a sense of reinforcement where you feel like folks here understand me. They know what I've been through today. They know what I'm going to go through. It's like when you're out of town and you bump into someone wearing Badger gear or they're wearing Green Bay Packers colors. You just sort of feel like, hey, that's my people. I can strike up a conversation with that person. When you have those kinds of spaces, it gives you a chance to feel like you really belong. And then you can let your hair down, so to speak, and relax after a day of being the first and only. But if in your social life, you're still trailblazing, you're still answering questions about can your hair be touched, or being asked if you saw some major news headline having to do with black people. There's a lot of things that's going on in the world, but rarely will people walk up to me, strangers, and ask me about something that's truly worldwide. It would be something really focused on, did you hear what Jesse Jackson did, or did you hear what President Obama said? And so we have to balance that off, because if people don't have a chance to unwind, they'll always be uptight. And then that we now are learning that that has health implications. And so if there's no space to really let down your hair and to relax and to connect and to recreate, it's just too costly here to stay in Wisconsin, and people opt to live other places. So this will give people the chance to have downtime to be refreshed so that they can re-engage the reality of state demographics so that we can become a part of the solution.
You mentioned this as an aspect of well-being, and you've said wellness is going to be a major focus of the center. And in that Journal Sentinel piece I mentioned, you wrote, a physical place like the center can improve health outcomes for Black people. Connect the dots.
Sure, by relieving stress. What we have learned, particularly through the University of Wisconsin's Medical School and School of Public Policy, that there's a connection between the stress that takes place when a person of color is navigating streams that are mainly white. The code switching, the innuendo, those things cause a level of stress that show up in diabetes and hypertension, two diseases which can be indicators for the onset of dementia. So many of the health inequities are rooted in stress, which means that they are diseases that can be avoided or overturned if you just change your stress levels and exercise and worked out differently. So now my big push is not just finding a place for Black people to hear Black music and eat Black pastries. It's really about living longer lives. That's what the excellence part of our name really means to me. So for me, the big opportunity is, how do we help the quality of life of Black people who have been a part, who have a legacy in making Wisconsin better and great for everyone, yet we're dying sooner than our white counterparts, largely due to stress? That's unfair, and that's undue pressure.
There's been a reaction to various elements of whatever you want to call it, diversity movements, DEI movements lately, along the lines of, you know, when you focus on a racial group in this way, you're actually heightening the division. You're drawing a deeper line between, say, Black and white in this case. And some listeners might be thinking, well, is the center going to be doing that? Is this somehow divisive? How would you address that concern?
First of all, that's not true. When a person walks into an ER because they've had an accident, no one says, well, you're just focusing on their illness and that makes them more sick. No, we need to isolate them. That's why they walk through the ER doors and not the front door or the door of a clinic. What's happening with populations of color in this country, particularly in the state of Wisconsin, are methodical and they're systemic. And unless we isolate them and take a look at them, we never will address them. And if we allow systems to be built and racism to persist so that a group of people have different economic outcomes, health outcomes, academic outcomes, then we say we can't focus on those things now. It's like putting people in an environment where they're forced to live with secondhand smoke, and then we refuse to give treatments for tuberculosis or lung disease or any other pulmonary diseases. If we continue down this track, we're going to create a great problem. And we're not trying to put more attention just on Black people. We're trying to put attention on where attention has not been placed. We're trying to bring people to the table. We're not trying to elevate them among others. And if Black people don't have space, like the center, to recalibrate themselves or recombobulate. I think that's a sign I see in the airports.
Walking
now.
Airport, yeah.
And I love that sign. I love that word. I hope I'm saying. Am I saying that right?
Recombobulation area. They call
if
it.
If we don't recombobulate, we will always be off kilter. And so for me, it's frightening that we can be discombobulated for the past 400 years. And when we try to get our stuff together, it's called wrong or illegal. So I would say to you, anyone else who's listening, it is erroneous and it is harmful to think that by focusing on a group that is systemically lacked and not due to its own lack, to say that now we can't make the injured party whole is creating a whole new reality for generations to come. And I don't want to be any part of that. I'm trying to avoid that by doing the work we're doing.
We're talking about the new Center for Black Excellence and Culture, groundbreaking coming up later this month on Juneteenth, June 19th. The center's founder is with us, Alex G., lead pastor of Fountain of Life Covenant Church in Madison. Now, I know groundbreaking is just coming up. You got another year before it's open. I know the particular programs aren't set yet, but take us on a tour of the spaces and the kinds of things that are going to happen in the center.
Sure. I will say this. During the 18 months of construction, we're going to be holding events in the community to give people a foretaste of what the center will be like. So we had a Black Artist Expo last December. We had workshops teaching Black youth how to audition for plays. But we will there will be programs when you walk into the center for seniors and for intergenerational connections. So for seniors to read to kids who are involved in programming and vice versa. There will be an educational program so that school districts can bring all children to the center to understand and learn about the contributions of Black folks to the state of Wisconsin. There'll be two theaters in the space. So during the day, there'll be performances that children will come to. I'm sure there'll be local businesses that will rent out the conference rooms and the auditoriums for their meetings. There'll be artistic maker space so people can come and work on their craft. Business incubator space so those same artists can, once they finish creating art, there's another area within our facility where they can work with mentors to put together business plans or figuring out how do they sell their art online or how do they get their work contracted. There'll be a library, there'll be an art gallery. And so there'll be places to stimulate our thought, places to create with our art, nooks for coffee. There'll be a coffee shop. We'll have a liquor license. So there'll be a bar for receptions for weddings that we'll host. It'll be just a great gathering place that allows us to be our best in this community.
And Reverend G., as we wrap up, for you personally, you've been working on this project for years, above and beyond your actual day job. What does it feel like for you to be, at the, it's not exactly the finish line, but at this critical point of you're about to break ground on this?
It feels so wonderful to be able to create a civic entity that will be respected and visited from all around the state. Because, with our touchscreens inside this space and artwork and tribute stories, we're really talking about Black influence and Black first from around the entire state. And, in my work as a pastor, we often think about what does life look like outside the four walls? And to do something that's not for our church, not just for Madison, but for the entire state of Wisconsin, by looking at the great contributions of its Black population, feels like I'm contributing on a huge level, and I'm standing on the shoulders of so many great men and women who have given their lives for this state and would love nothing more than for their descendants to feel that they are equally Wisconsinite. Means a lot to me. So I feel a lot of responsibility, a lot of pride. I've got a lot of bruises on my legs from pinching myself and asking, is this really happening on my watch? So I feel very fortunate to be in this role and position and can't wait until the entire community and state can celebrate the opening of the center with us.
Reverend G., thanks so much for joining us in the studio.
It's my pleasure being here. Thank you for inviting me.
That was Reverend Alex G., lead pastor of Fountain of Life Covenant Church in Madison and founder of the Center for Black Excellence and Culture. You can find more from our conversation online at WPR.org.
Over the next 2 weeks, we'll meet some legendary figures with strong ties to Wisconsin communities. Think Frank Lloyd Wright with the world-famous Taliesin near Spring Green and World War II ace pilot Richard Bong from Poplar and Superior.
That leads to our question for you. Who is a famous person associated with your community that maybe put your hometown on the map?
Are they a household name with a famous story, or do you wish you knew more about them? Either way, let us know. You can call, text us at 888-642-0232, or you can email at wisconsintoday@wpr.org.
Share your local legends with us, and then we can share their story with the rest of the state.
Wisconsin Today is the work of a team of producers, hosts, and technical directors. Learn more about us at wpr.org/Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to WPR News.